here I am. There was a defendant who was on trial, and there was strong evidence indicating guilt. But it was a murder trial, and there was no corpse anywhere to be found. In the defense's closing statement, the lawyer, knowing that his client would probably get convicted by the evidence, resorted to a trick. "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury," he said, "I have a surprise for you all." And then he looked at his watch. "Within 1 minute, the person presumed to have died in this case will walk through those doors of the courtroom." And then the lawyer looked towards the courtroom doors, and the jurors, somewhat stunned, all looked on eagerly at the doors. A minute passed and nothing happened. Finally, the lawyer said, "Actually, I made up the previous statement, but you all looked on with anticipation. I therefore put to you that there is reasonable doubt in this case as to whether anyone was actually killed, and insist that you return a verdict of not guilty." Well, the jury, clearly confused, retired to deliberate. A few minutes later, the jury returned and pronounced the verdict of guilty. "But how?" inquired the defense attorney. "You must have had some doubt. I saw you all look at the door." The jury foreman replied, "Oh, we looked, but your client didn't." I've come to understand more and more that the one thing people want more than anything else, it seems, in this world is certainty. Most people want to know that the ground they are standing on will not shift. The problem is, as we all know deep in our hearts, there is very little certainty in this life. But that hasn't stopped many people, some well-meaning ones included, to try and promote some kind of certainty, at least as they define it. Politicians are adept at this exercise, aren't they? They claim to know what is certainly best for all of us. In terms of faith, Christian or otherwise, the desire for certainty leads to what we might call fundamentalism or rigidity or dogmatism. And often those positions are based on poor scholarship or theology. This latter point occurs because if we cannot fit a concept or an idea into our rigid framework, it has to be jettisoned or reinterpreted to fit our framework. Religious leaders who promise certainty are really popular because they believing something is certain is really easy on you and I. It is. Thomas Moore uses a musical analogy to describe the nature of fundamentalism. I thought it was quite brilliant. If you go to a piano and you strike a low C hard, you will hear, whether you know it or not, a whole series of tones. You will hear the fundamental note very clearly, but it would sound very strange if it didn't also include some overtones like C and G's, E, and even a B-flat. Jake Heppner writes, "In other words, fundamentalism has always narrowed the focus, causing one to think simplistically about whatever concept someone is contemplating. There are reasons why people become fundamentalists," Heppner says. "First, the mind always looks for clear-cut, rational, and summary meaning for everything it encounters. It is uncomfortable with ambiguity. And second, our insecurities call us for foundational certainties that we can use in defense of our fears related to choice, responsibility, and change." He goes on to say, once you become a true fundamentalist, you can basically stop thinking. Someone has done that for you. And you can press all the experiences of life into precast molds. You don't expect to learn or to experience anything new. But our souls crave more than fundamental facts and cookie-cutter molds. They thirst for nuance, and they thirst for overtone. The failure of fundamentalism, then, in this context, is that it defines truth and life in terms of brittle facts and singular meaning. Fundamentalism may give birth to passion, but it is incapable of nurturing the deepest needs of our souls. If I had a nickel for every time someone has come up to me and said, just tell me what to believe, I'd be pretty rich, wouldn't I? Frankly, I don't want that responsibility. Never have. I would rather present to you thoughts and concepts and theology for your consideration. I am determined to see folks put forth an effort to learn, to wrestle with ideas, or examine sacred texts in appropriately scholarly ways. Just because someone has a degree or a pulpit or a radio or television show does not mean that they are correct. In Christian circles, questions about interpretation and cultural bias, historical meaning, and a host of other influences on the Bible are often rejected by a lot of people because of the name of certainty, or in the name of certainty. Uncertainty, we know, breeds doubt. And doubt frightens us. When in actual fact, doubt can often lead to new growth, a deeper understanding, and a renewed faith. I say all this to you because our Old Testament lesson today comes at a time of great uncertainty. It is a passage that we have a pretty good idea of when it happened. Uzziah, who was the ancient king of Judah, died in 740 or 739 BC, depending on how you calculate the years. Uzziah became king of Judah at the ripe old age of 16, and he reigned for 52 years. In the early part of his reign, Uzziah was heavily influenced by a prophet named Zechariah. He's not the same one who wrote the book, by the way, in the Bible. And Uzziah, at least in the beginning, was very faithful to God. 2 Kings 15 verse 3 reads that Uzziah did what was right in the eyes of God. And for all intents and purposes, at least early on, Uzziah was a good king for Judah. Beyond his obedience to God, Uzziah made many improvements to the military defense of Jerusalem. And according to 2 Chronicles 26, his armies defeated the Philistines and the Arabians, and he received tributes from the Ammonites. That means he controlled the Ammonites so much that they were at Uzziah's mercy. He was a vigorous and capable ruler. He was even known to be inscribed on the gates of Egypt in 2 Chronicles 26. However, Uzziah's pride got the best of him. As his reign wore on, he began to take more and more liberties, thinking he could do whatever he wanted. And this led to his eventual downfall. In a violation of the law of Moses, Uzziah enters the temple one day and he burns incense on the altar of incense. And although he sought to honor God, he had trespassed into forbidden territory. You see, the burning of incense was restricted exclusively to priests, to those who were descendants of Aaron. Azariah the high priest was so angry at what the king did, he actually confronted the king with a group of 80 priests. The Bible tells us that as punishment, God struck Uzziah immediately with leprosy. And he was forced, due to his uncleanliness, to flee the temple and to live the remainder of his days in isolation. The government, feeling that it was rudderless, had no other choice. They handed the throne over to Uzziah's son, Jotham, who was not the man his father was. Jotham was reckless with his faith, and he plunged the kingdom into uncertainty. So this is where we find ourselves when Isaiah goes up to the temple to pray. Isaiah is overcome with uncertainty. And as a prophet attuned to the nation of Judah and also with God, he senses the wind is shifting. What is to become of the nation of Judah and his beloved city of Jerusalem now that King Uzziah has died? Uncertainty reigns in Isaiah's heart. But he just simply represents what the entire nation is feeling. Everyone is fretting. Everyone wants a firm place to plant their feet. If uncertainty is a problem for us as individuals, imagine what happens when it becomes a collective experience. I know how Isaiah feels. I also know how the people of Judah feel. I look around me in this world and I can feel the uncertainty. It seems to be pervading every nook and cranny of life. And there are plenty of causes for that feeling, isn't there? We're at the climax of a provincial election. And we've got no idea what our neighbors to the south are doing in terms of foreign policy. And it scares us. We are struggling to know who to believe and who to trust. Isaiah does the very right thing. He takes his uncertainty, he takes the uncertainty of the nation, and he goes into the temple to pray to God. And what happens next and what forms our lesson for today can only be described very inadequately as wow. Even the words of the prophet do not seem to do justice to what he experiences there. Isaiah has a vision. A jaw-dropping, knock-your-socks-off vision. Isaiah sees God sitting on a throne high and lifted up. Now, there's no reference here made that Isaiah actually gazed at God's face. That's important. Most Hebrew people believe that if you saw God's face, you would immediately die. We're told that the hem of God's robe was so vast that it filled the entire temple. The whole temple is filled with smoke, indicating that there was a continual burning of incense. And that smoke obscured the scene. It gave it more mystery and otherworldliness. Attending to God are seraphs, a kind of angelic being. They had six wings. Two they used to cover their faces, two they used to cover their feet, and two they used to fly. And the imagery here is very significant. The placement of their wings is out of respect for God's holiness. God is so holy, they don't dare look at him, so they cover their faces. And the feet were considered the most unclean part of someone, so they covered their feet. Then we're told that the seraphs flew around and they called to each other repeatedly, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory." It says their voices shook the pivots. Unfortunately, we don't have any idea what the Hebrew word pivot means. We don't know what that means. But suffice it to say, their voices just thundered. And a vibration went out throughout the temple. Not only is this scene jaw-dropping, the word oft offered repeatedly holy instills a further dimension of just how powerful this scene is. You know, we modern people, we've kind of lost a sense of what the holy means. The respect for the sacred has been lost to us, I think. The word holy is often used in our common parlance as an adjective. We often use it as an exclamation point, don't we? Holy blank. You can fill that in. Rarely do we ever find ourselves just stopped in our tracks and brought to our knees by the holy, by the sacred. But Isaiah was. This scene, this experience, it wrecked him. He knew what was before him, and his sense of unworthiness just washed over him. You know, there's a similar scene that takes place in the New Testament. It's in Luke chapter 5, when Jesus calls Peter. After catching so many fish that his nets begin to break, the Bible tells us that Peter fell to his knees, and he asked Jesus to depart from him. Because he was a sinful man. Isaiah says, "Woe is me. I'm lost. For I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Isaiah is well aware that in this glorious scene of God on a throne, incense burning, seraphs flying and calling out, he is like a blot. He's a stain. Furthermore, he knows there's absolutely nothing he can do to make himself worthy to be there. Isaiah needs someone to cleanse him, to make him worthy. So what happens? One of the seraphs flies over to the altar and retrieves a hot coal from the altar with a pair of tongs. He flies over and he touches Isaiah's lips, thus cleansing him. The result of this touching with the hot coal is forgiveness. Isaiah is now ready. But ready for what? Let me state for the record that this passage is not a passage about Isaiah's call to ministry. Isaiah was already a prophet before this passage. What this is something else. Something every faithful servant of God needs. We are all called, but we also need to be sent or commissioned. A call is a setting aside, but a setting aside for what? Isaiah was a prophet, but what was his purpose? So God asked, "Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?" Notice the word "us" here. This being Trinity Sunday, scholars like to point that out, that that's maybe a reference to the Trinity. I share that with you. Think of Isaiah's vision as akin to what a minister experiences. We complete our training and seminary because we believe God has called us to this vocation. But all the preparation, all the obedience to the call is absolutely empty unless we're directed, unless we're sent somewhere, to someone, to live out our calling. And as a good Baptist who believes in the priesthood of all believers, I know that we're all called, and therefore we're all sent and we're all commissioned. And that commissioning can be as varied as there are people. Commissioning that infuses our work, our relationships, our recreation with our God-given purpose. In Jesus' words, we're to be light and salt. Can I suggest that Isaiah's encounter with God brought him a new intimacy with God? Being in such close proximity with the holiness of God, God's concerns became Isaiah's concerns. In such intimacy with God, the things that broke God's heart broke his heart and should break our hearts. We are therefore sent, as Isaiah was sent, out into the world to meet head on the suffering of the world, the uncertainty of the world. No wonder the Apostle Paul wrote, "I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing to the glory about to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God, for the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own, but by the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will offer the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, and not only creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly while we wait adoption and redemption of our bodies." Paul's right. I shared with you before, I can feel it. The world groans. We groan too. We long for something better, something more certain, but are we aware of what it will take to move the world to something better? Tony Campola tells of a time a young man was dragged into his office and forced into a chair in his office by a very angry father. And the father was very upset about how his son's life was going, but not the way you might at first think. The father said the following: "I sent him to college to get a good education, to make something of himself, and people like you got his head turned around. Look at him now. He's doing mission work. He's out on the streets with pimps and whores and drug pushers. He's always giving his money to poor old ladies. He's living like a pauper, and all he cares about is reaching out to losers of the world. Then as a kicker, the father said, "Don't get me wrong, Campolo. I don't mind being a Christian up to a point." That's the problem, isn't it? Aren't we all willing and able to be Christian up to a point? Isaiah's vision in the temple was a truly marvelous gift, but it was absolutely necessary to move Isaiah beyond the point he'd already reached. God wanted him to take another step, to go and take a message to Judah, and it was not the nicest message they were to receive if you read further on in the passage. In a time of great uncertainty, with more uncertainty to come, how was Isaiah to move ahead? Simply put, he'd encountered the one in which there was absolute certainty. Kings may come and go, but God is still the ruler of the earth. How does the old hymn go? "On the solid rock I stand. All other ground is sinking sand." Uncertainty should never frighten us. Ever. Nor should uncertainty force us to circle the wagons to keep out those things that challenge us. Because if God is for us, who can be against us? And nothing is more certain than the King of Kings.